You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. And guess what? There was a lot that went on. My guest today, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and our own James Dawson is also joining us for a little bit to talk all things legislature, since he's been there, I believe, for 95 days at the State House. Is
that
right?
Who's counting?
Who's counting that?
So, none of us. Definitely none of us.
So let's dive right in. The session is officially over.
Thank goodness. Oh, my gosh. 95 legislative days. I have been covering the legislature for a while. This is the longest one since 2009.
Well, okay, I was going to ask how if we hit a record on this one.
We did not hit a record, but it's the longest in 10 years.
Yeah, and I came from the Delaware legislature, too, and I covered that for 5 years, and we go 6 months over there. So.
Oh, so James, you could head back today.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, they're about to go on Easter break right now, but yeah.
So get us updated on that kind of last, really, day or two, because a lot went down.
Absolutely. And the
25 words or less.
Yeah. 25 words or less. It was a circus. Nobody knew what was going on. The thing is, a lot of the debates those last few days of the legislative session were very wonky and technical, but they were critically important to the functioning of Idaho state government. Basically, there was an argument going on about the passage of administrative rules in the state of Idaho. And I can, if I listen hard enough, I can hear everybody's eyes glaze over
right.
just audibly. But it really is important. When the legislature passes laws, these departments and divisions then pass rules that kind of fill in the blanks, right? Like, this is how the citizens of Idaho interact with their state government on a daily basis. If you want to get a license to be a pharmacist, if you want to if you want to test your well, that all comes down to administrative rules. And there was a fight going on about how those rules would be approved by both the House and the Senate. And at the end of the day, the legislature couldn't agree on a path forward, and they left without extending the administrative rules, not just the ones that they had approved this year, but all of them.
More than 8,000 pages of rules.
So Jimmy,
and they just left.
So Jimmy, what does that mean then? I mean, in the sense of, because as you said this morning to me in our newsroom, Jimmy, you go, it is probably the most boring subject ever, but the most important thing that probably happened at the State House this session.
Oh, definitely. And all of those conversations were generally behind closed doors, we should note. So what happens now is, since they were not renewed, then come July 1st, they're all going to expire. And that means a lot of work on the back end for the governor's office and the heads of each agency to really revive them as, quote, temporary rules. And that's important because temporary rules will come back next legislative session, and they have to be approved by both the House and the Senate, whereas some rules only need approval by one. And that was the big thing that the House Republicans wanted. They wanted both chambers to sign off on rules regardless of what kind they were.
All that said, an executive order takes care of this, right? I mean, they're temporary, but to the person at the kitchen table,
what can the governor do?
The state government isn't going to shut down.
So, no. And so for Idaho Reports this week, airing at 8 o'clock tonight, we talked to Alex Adams, the head of the Division of Financial Management. He works very closely with Governor Brad Little. And he assured me and our viewers that the average Idahoan will not see a disruption in their interactions with state government, that they are going to work to ensure whatever it takes that these rules will not just expire and it's going to be anarchy in the state of Idaho and no one's going to know, you know, what DEQ standards they have to meet with their water or what teachers have to teach. That he said that is not going to happen. He also said that they haven't taken any options off of the table. I mentioned specifically in our interview with him special session, and it's a possibility. It's a possibility, because otherwise I think there are a lot of things that are up in the air as far as whether they would have to approve every single rule or just the ones that have had recent changes, like the ones they did this year and the ones that they were going to re-examine this summer.
Well, and we should say that this could potentially cost a lot of money. I mean, I spoke with the person who is the head of the administrative rules part of government, and he said it could cost up to $400,000. It could take his staff, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to do all of this work. So it's not necessarily going to come cheap, even though the House Republicans in their end-of-session press conference yesterday seemed to say, oh, it'll only take, you know, 48 hours, and it's not going to cost a whole lot of money. But some people are really disputing that.
There are a lot of unanswered questions here. And, you know, I think a lot of people are really starting to wonder whether a special session where the governor calls lawmakers back and says, you know what, you have unfinished business and I need you to get to work and this is what you're going to do.
Yeah, but there's a bunch of legislators who like the fact that they're going to have to approve all these things, right? That's what the fight was about, was who gets to approve them. So if you don't have a special session, you come back in 2019 and they get what they want.
Or 2020, right. Yeah.
2020, I'm sorry. They get the permission to approve them. Mm-hmm. So I think people will remember the fight over science standards a year ago that had to be approved through this rule process. And so it was basically a debate over climate change, how Idaho curriculum was going to reflect climate change. Mm-hmm. So I do think there are relevant moments when, you know, when the public has engaged and been aware of this process. What I don't understand as kind of a casual observer of the legislature is why this fight now?
We've been doing this for a while.
So why
at
why
the very
now?
End of the session?
Well, and why in 2019?
Yeah.
So it wasn't actually at the end of the session that this first came up. House Bill 100, which was introduced, I think, at the end of January, early February.
It was fairly
exactly
early.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And the It's not one thing that tipped it over. Certainly, it was the climate change fight from last year, but also there was a court order last year that over Idaho reissuing birth certificates to transgender individuals who wanted their birth certificate to reflect their gender, and said, you know what, my birth certificate said that I was born as a male, but I am living as
a
woman.
Female, and
exactly, and that had to be reflected in administrative rules for the Department of Health and Welfare. And there were a lot of people who objected to that. The department said, you know what, we have a court order here. And remember how many controversial things end up in administrative rules. Climate change is just one of many examples. Common Core, vaccinations, DEQ standards, the birth certificate issue. There are so many things. The vast majority of them are mundane and administrative. But there are some controversial issues in there.
It seems you can't tell me then that come July 1, there might not be some chaos.
Well, and that's what the administration is trying to avoid.
But is this acrimony a result of
all the fighting
what happened
that's been
in the
happening?
Last 7 days? Everything from the hemp bill to the Medicaid back and forth?
This has been...
And this was the tipping point?
I don't know that this was the tipping point. This has been an undercurrent fight for a long time. So as Jimmy and I were discussing, House Bill 100 was introduced fairly early on in the session, passed the House, and wasn't even heard in the Senate. And it was one of many things that the House was upset about because the Senate chairman weren't hearing these bills.
Well, I want to talk really quickly, too, about some other things that happened in the legislature. So Governor Little, last week, we talked right here on the Reporter Roundtable, and even as Bill and Kevin Richards said, you know, we're talking about this at noon, we re-air at 8 p.m., and this could be moot. And it was, because Governor Little had vetoed Senate Bill 1159.
The voter initiative bill.
Then we get Medicaid, and he signs that with sideboards. Talk to me, Melissa and Jimmy, about the emotions within the State House when that happened.
I think confusion would be the first one, because there was a lot of miscommunication about how the letter was posted on Governor Little's website initially, labeled as a veto letter. So if you didn't look at the link, it looked like Governor Little had vetoed Medicaid expansion, which we know now that didn't happen. Then you click on the link and there was an incomplete letter. It was basically, it looked like a draft had been posted.
There was a paragraph missing. Yeah,
sentences that would trail off mid-sentence and everything. So it took about 15 minutes for it to finally get sorted out. Like, okay, he signed the bill. But then when you read the letter, it says, you know, I approve this bill. But then he lists all of his problems and concerns with it and points out that there could be legal challenges. It sounded exactly like a veto letter. It really, really did. Had you taken off that first paragraph, had that been the one missing, I would have thought it was a veto message because he listed multiple problems he had with it. But at the end of the day, I think lawmakers were relieved because the vast majority of them, I should say, because it meant that they could go home. There was an end in sight. Democrats and a handful of Republicans were obviously upset. The ones who opposed the work requirements in the first place cited a number of issues that they feel will be coming up, including a heftier price tag than maybe some are anticipating.
Yeah. And I think that some of those Democrats and Republicans who did oppose the Medicaid sideboards issue took a little bit of solace in that they don't think that a good number of the waivers would be approved, or if they were approved, they'd get challenged in court and be struck down. So that would include like the work requirements, maybe the one requirement that would force well, women and men who are seeking like birth control or family planning care, or whatever it might be, to get a referral from their primary care doctor. They think that that one might go as well. So they think it's just going to be a long fight. They were very disappointed, but they think they might come out on top in the end.
Has anyone quantified what gap will remain?
That's one of the big unknowns. So we talked to the new director of the Department of Health and Welfare, Dave Jeppesen, for this week's show. And he emphasized that the only thing we know right now is that regardless of what happens with the waivers and Medicaid expansion, the clean Medicaid expansion, at the very least, will go live on January 1st, 2020. And that this waiver process is going to potentially be lengthy. I was actually surprised at how long it might take. It might take more than a year until we have an answer on how this might look. And that is without potential court challenges.
Well, I was going to say, and you know that's going to happen. I mean, that would be shocking if it didn't. Bill, you mentioned something in an email to me that I thought was interesting, and about the rural-urban divide being bigger than ever, and this really showing up within the session this year.
Yeah, you actually had legislators who were not demeaning, but discounting the value of the witnesses who came to the committee hearings, saying, well, they're just Boise people. They don't really reflect what we're hearing in our districts. They don't really reflect the state of the sense of the state. And so you have that issue playing out with Medicaid expansion. You have that issue playing out with these new rules for getting a ballot measure on the
urban
ballot.
Renewal.
Right, which is all about making sure, one would argue, making sure that there are more rural voters who having a bigger voice in that process. So in addition to this weird kind of House-Senate tension that bubbled up really prominently at the end of the session, I think you have this really powerful urban-rural divide that is showing that it's stronger than ever in Idaho. Mm-hmm.
And I think there is something to be said for what lawmakers are hearing from their own constituents in their districts. Idaho is a very big state with very different populations between the east and the west and the north and the south. Not everybody showed the contempt for Boise voter or Boise constituents who showed up to testify, but it came up more than once that there was some palpable tension there that you know what, we could just leave and let districts 15, 16, 17, and 18 and 19 listen to their constituents because it's different than what we're hearing at home.
And it sounded more overt than it has in the past.
Absolutely.
You used to kind of hear rumblings and grumblings. Mm-hmm. Now it's right out there. But, you know, 35 of the 44 counties in Idaho did pass the Medicaid expansion. This is not like it passed in three or four urban counties and that was it.
And that was interesting too, because yesterday at the end of session press conference, you had Representative Megan Blanksma, who has a very rural district. I mean, we're talking like Owyhee County over into Elmore, I believe. And she was saying, talking about how, you know, they're she's hearing from her constituents about how they want work requirements with Medicaid expansion, et cetera. And I asked her, I was like, but your constituents did pass Medicaid. They voted on Prop 2. And she said, yes, but we need to protect the voices of the minorities. And that was her answer.
But even though the governor vetoed the legislation, I think the most transparent example of it were the voter initiative hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was so transparent of that divide.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And And Bill, as you had mentioned, you said, you know, it seems like there is this fight that Boise's just getting too big for its britches, and whether it is or not, there is that you can feel that now.
You can. It just strikes me. I said it before. It feels like it's more out in the open than it used to be. And I don't know if it's. I mean, imagine you're coming to Boise for 3 months from a struggling rural community somewhere in Idaho, and you see all these cranes and all these hotels and all these restaurants and all these people, and you've got to think.
And then you read every list that they just keep making.
You've got to think. You know, Boise's got it good, and they don't appreciate how good they have it. And we need to share this with the rest of the state.
And these lawmakers aren't stupid. They know that the census is coming up and that triggers redistricting and that urban rural divide is going to get...
It's going to get greater.
It's going to get greater. And Boise, the Treasure Valley as a whole, its influence is going to get even greater. Mm-hmm. That is a big reason why you're seeing this tension right now, because they're trying to protect those rural voices while they can before... The Treasure Valley gets even more lawmakers, because that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and watch out for Republicans to potentially bring up that redistricting constitutional amendment that was buried pretty quickly earlier this session.
Continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television are joining me. George, fascinating article coming out of the Boise Weekly regarding women hiking solo in Idaho.
So... I've known this writer for a little while. Her name is Hayden Sader. She lives in the Sun Valley area, and she writes mostly about recreation and sometimes music, etc. I'll give you a little background, though. She told me that she submitted this story to three other regional publications, and they said, nah, not interested. Stunning. I said, give me this story. Give me this story. It was already written and researched. So I had a chance to speak to a couple of the women that she refers to in this story. Because we do not identify their names. Mm-hmm. And it's harrowing. That said, I don't think it's probably much of a surprise to a number of people in the story. It refers to a survey, an outdoor magazine, that said that I think more than 53% of the women who responded said that they had been harassed in the outdoors or recreated in the outdoors.
Let's put it this way. I'll give a little bit of commentary right now.
Yeah.
As a woman... This is not surprising.
Not at all.
Not at all. And when I moved here 20 years ago and I heard about the Greenbelt, and they're like, oh, you can go on the Greenbelt. I was like, are you people crazy? This because they didn't patrol it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just in the city.
Yep.
Right? This is, as a woman, this is not surprising.
And the point is that this is a conversation, quite frankly, that men need to be having.
That's exactly.
So you can guess what social media is, how they're reacting to this story, and it has erupted, and it has turned into a big debate about guns and men wagging their fingers at women about, this is what you need to do, or demeaning the writer of this article.
Or we can be respectful of people when they're solo hiking.
Yeah.
I know this is radio. Can you hear me rolling my eyes?
Right.
I just... Oh, my gosh.
So, yes. So I apologize that it's an obvious story. That said, honestly, I do, because I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed not to. It's like, George. And I handed this to the young women in our newsroom, and they said, well, yes, this is my story. And
I people are talking because you published it.
That she wrote it. I was just lucky.
No, but the fact that three other publications said no to it. So... It goes back to the fact that if
recreation publications.
Right. But if we do not talk about this, then nothing will change.
That said, Bill, you've explored this.
In several ways. Yeah. I spent a lot of time in the backcountry, and I've done a lot of backpacking and hiking, some of it solo. And I have a 20-something daughter who also is a solo hiker who has experienced, you know, harassment and rude comments in situations where you feel really vulnerable. I also have a friend who was in the Boulder White Claws, I think, two summers ago or three. I don't remember now. I asked her if we could write about it, and she didn't want to talk about it. But she and another woman who was hiking with her ran into some guys with guns who were shooting their guns and making comments and making veiled threats at them. And they cut their short. They cut their trip short and came back. And it was really disconcerting for them. I would say, though— this is a conversation that men should have. In my years in the backcountry, there are more and more women hiking,
yep.
more and more women, all women groups, all of which is fantastic. But I do think solo hiking is dangerous for a man or a woman. And I think one of the things, if there's anything we can do, it's not go by ourselves.
Right.
But you just described a situation in which two women together were harassed together by a group of men. So it's not just – certainly there are dangers in solo hiking and trekking, and I have gotten more and more into it over the years. And I never feel more empowered than when I am backpacking or when I am summiting a very, very big mountain, and it's very difficult, and I'm there, and nothing makes me more mad than the fact that some dude, some jerk, thinks that he can make me feel small out on the trail. And again, like, I'm so grateful that the Boise Weekly published this. Again, it wasn't a surprise because I have traveled alone internationally and everything like that. And that's what I'm always more concerned about.
Well, we live in a culture where I think we are taught as from a very young age as girls to you have to watch your back. I mean, it is just a part of who we are growing up as women. I mean, and the same things need to be said for men in the sense of, look, I tell my boys, you know, you need to be safe. You need to do this. You need to do that. There is an added layer to it when you are a woman about being safe, if that makes sense.
Well, and Gemma, you and I are both the mothers of little boys.
Yes.
And that's part of, I think, parenting men is that you need to, not you, Gemma, but we as a society need to teach these little boys that that kind of behavior isn't appropriate. And I think that's something that has unfortunately been missing in some previous generations.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to make the point that in 2017, Ruth Brown at the Statesman did a series of stories about women outdoor guides who were talking about some of these very same issues. And, you know, and if you're a woman, if you're anybody as a guide in the outdoors, you're in a subservient role anyway, and you've got wealthy people who are paying for your services. It's not a big step for them to think that they maybe deserve more
other
than just
treatment,
right? And so this is an issue that has been out there, and I think it's worth exploring. And I'm glad to see George mm-hmm. and his crew doing that.
But the power that we carry as men, or people with money, or people with guns, is to be acknowledged, and it has to be. There has to be a lid put on this, and we mm-hmm. need to be talking about this.
Absolutely.
And the most harrowing story in here involved two women who were together, who spent a night in hell in a cabin in fear of these men who were just outside mm-hmm. their cabin. And that's a very common story, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to switch gears some. There was a lot we needed to get to in this, but this was such an important topic. Very quickly, new University of Idaho president and alumni being named C. Scott Green, I believe.
C. Scott Green.
It sounds like a Dr. Seuss. and he will begin July 1, and then a Boise State University. It sounds like the Board of Ed will make their decision on April 23rd. So needed to get that there. But I really want to quickly talk about an announcement that came, I believe, yesterday or Wednesday.
This week.
Yeah. That was huge within media circles, but in Idaho, and that is Dee Sartin at KTVB Channel 7 announcing her retirement come June 6th. 40 years at KTVB.
She's earned it. She's earned it. But man, I'm going to miss her. I grew up watching her. 40 years at KTVB.
My husband does not remember a news anchor before Dee.
Right, right. Same. Absolutely. And I grew up watching her, and when I moved back to Boise with my family and got into TV, I didn't have any broadcast training. And I met Dee a couple times fairly early on in my career. I had a couple seasons under my belt on Idaho Reports, and she was so kind to me. She said that she liked my show. And then as the years went on, the KTVB invited me to participate in some of their debates, and we worked with them for our debates on Idaho Public Television. Dee pulled me aside and said that she was, what did she say? She was so impressed by my political knowledge and my journalism, and she really appreciated what I brought to the table. And I got to my car and cried because I had looked up to Dee Sartin for so long. And she is so kind and gracious.
Oh, she is.
And the Boise media market has been so much better for her being involved, and I'm going to miss her.
You I spent many, many years at the Statesman, and we cried because we were competitors with Channel 7 for all those years.
We all were.
And right.
And as long as Dee was there, you were never going to be number one.
I mean, it strikes me that, you know, remarkable career, 40 years in one market, you know, that's there are very few people you can mention in that kind of breath, you know, mm-hmm. the Tim Woodwards of the worlds, the Pete Zamowskis. And are we ever going to see a media world again where someone has the kind of time, is given the kind of time to develop that rapport with the community to be able to do that work for decades and decades? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're ever going to see that again, and I think we're all the worse for it.
I did a profile piece for her here when I was hosting Morning Edition. And the thing, and so she said, meet me at, and I think it was a high school football game, where she sing, and I guess to this day continues to sing the national anthem. Mm-hmm. And by the way, her singing voice, hello.
And her daughter.
And her daughter.
Yeah. But a sweet woman, and you are usually the most important person to her when you meet her.
Absolutely.
Wow. You're not going to see that too often in our circles.
And I will tell you this, that I think for people who have never had the opportunity to meet Dee, you've had the opportunity to meet her if you've watched her on television, because she is who she is. And that's hard to find, I think. But I agree with you, Melissa. I mean, when I moved here 20 years ago and we started Fox 12, this little startup station, and the first time I meet Dee, she says to me, she goes, I watch your broadcast. I think you do such a nice job. And I was like, you do?
Right?
It is. Because even then, 20 years ago, she was an icon in this market. It will never be the same.
No.
A lot of men have sat next to her over the years.
And she's...
And they've come and gone.
Yep.
So. She's a force. And her warmth really comes through on TV. I'm going to miss her so much. But like I said at the beginning of this conversation, she has earned her retirement. And I hope she enjoys it.
I hope she enjoys all those grandkids, like she has said. And you want the best for her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're out of time. One of these days, Bill, we're going to get to the fact that the jump slide is open again. Because, it's open.
Let's just have a special Idaho Reports field trip down to the jump slide, then we can report
back.
Can
we do a video segment of it?
Idaho Reports, Idaho Matters.
Everybody on the slide. George, you can be on the end. You'll be the spotter.
I need a note from my doctor.